I have to say, Zelensky's capacity to somehow fly across the globe in the middle of a war and give a speech in English in front of Congress that manages to unite the room at a moment when nothing unites the room and still be funny, I mean, it's just kind of amazing.
Well, you know, I guess when you have a comedian who's the president, right, it helps. But he is a master of, first of all, staying awake. I feel like he's been awake for 300 consecutive days.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer. Hi to you both.
Hey, Evan. So good to be with you again.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
The dangerous assault on American constitutional democracy that took place on January 6, 2021, consists of hundreds of individual criminal offenses.
The January 6th committee held its final public hearing this week.
We propose to the committee advancing referrals where the gravity of the specific offense, the severity of its actual harm, and the centrality of the offender to the overall design of the unlawful scheme to overthrow the election compel us to speak. Ours is not a system of justice where foot soldiers go to jail and the masterminds and ringleaders get a free pass.
And voted to make four criminal referrals against Donald Trump to the Department of Justice.
A recorded vote is requested. The clerk will call the roll.
Ms. Cheney?
Aye.
One count of obstruction, two of conspiracy, and one for inciting, assisting, or providing aid and comfort to an insurrection.
Aye.
Mr. Schiff?
Aye.
The enormous volume of material collected by the committee over their 18-month investigation is now being sent to the special counsel, Jack Smith, and what happens next is really anyone's guess.
Mr. Raskin?
Aye.
So today, we're going to look at how the January 6th committee has raised the stakes of a potential prosecution of Donald Trump and what comes next for the 45th president.
The clerk will report the vote.
Mr. Chairman, on this vote, there are 9 ayes and 0 noes.
The motion is agreed to. The select committee stands adjourned.
We are talking early in the afternoon on Thursday, and I think the committee's full findings are set to be released any moment. It may, in fact, happen while we're talking. Which part of the report are each one of you going to flip to first? Susan, what about you?
Well, Evan, look, they have done an extraordinary thing in terms of collecting and putting on the record testimony from more than 1,000 witnesses is what they say. And I think what we're looking for here is, have they turned up anything that would count as new evidence? What is the nexus that they're able to establish between the president and his advisors in the White House in this plot after the 2020 election, and those who actually fomented the insurrection on Capitol Hill. And so, you know, I'll be looking first and foremost among evidence, but I have to say, of course, as a writer who's had to write the history of this moment, the color is irresistible too. And, just the sheer range of human experience and, you know, the almost Shakespearean conflicts among Trump's circle as they clashed with each other and with him over what to do, filling in the portrait for history is something that inevitably, you know, we're going to want to be reading and, you know, sort of absorbing all the granular detail.
Jane, what are you going to look for first when it comes out?
Well, I mean, it's going to be gigantic. So you have to flip through with an eye towards a few specifics. And I have to admit that as someone who is a writer, I'm looking for color details too, that I wanted to see whether they held up. And one of the disputes that's been interesting is whether or not Cassidy Hutchins' description of the White House aide's description of the incredible scene where Trump lunged at the driver of his limousine in an effort to try to get him to take him up to Capitol Hill, whether that is going to survive at this point, because it was challenged, but it was challenged by people in the Secret Service who seem to, whose credibility, shall we say, seems to be suspect. And so I want to see whether that's going to hold up. Because really, when I think of a specific detail in here, it's one of the ones that was, to me, that made my mouth just drop open.
And Cassidy Hutchinson, of course, was an assistant to Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. And there was, as you say, that extraordinary moment when she gave us this image, which we had never seen in the American presidency, of the chief executive lunging towards his own security team to try to get them to do what he wanted. And do we know if the people who have testified are in a position to be able to dispute or confirm what she said?
It's interesting, Evan. They did in the executive summary, which they released the other day. So we do already have the first, 100 plus pages of this, the executive summary, and it looks like the committee went to some lengths to try to confirm and to bolster that testimony. They specifically, in fact, call out as suspect the testimony of Tony Ornato, who had overseen Trump's security and then became the deputy White House chief of staff. But the other testimony, according to the executive summary that they got that supports Cassidy Hutchinson's account, that is secondhand testimony, right? So it appears they cite another White House official with national security responsibilities. They cite multiple people who said they were told immediately after, in the hours and days after this incident about it, that Trump was quote unquote irate, that he was out of control. But I did not see in the executive summary yet any firsthand evidence. And that points out, I think, the limits of this investigation. And the limits of the investigation are it's not the Justice Department. They don't have the full ability to compel testimony. Many people refused to testify to the panel or simply took the Fifth Amendment. And I think that, that's where this criminal investigation by the Justice Department ultimately comes in.
Truly, I agree. And I think the reason that moment is important is sort of threefold. One, we want to know, did Trump at the time really want to go up to the Hill? Did he see himself specifically, personally obstructing the count that was going to certify Biden's election? It was an image that Giuliani floated at one point to Cassidy Hutchinson, saying that it was going to be, he was going to look so strong up there doing that. Is that what was really in his mind at that point? We want to know that. We want to know whether Hutchinson's credibility holds up also. And then I think the other thing that's of interest is how many of these witnesses who have taken the side of Trump in these hearings have been in some way tainted. There's the suggestion that there's an obstruction of justice situation in some of this, in which Trump's allies tried to stop the truth from coming out and maybe didn't tell the truth to the committee. And I think, again, as Susan's saying, it's a really good point. There's a tremendous difference between what a congressional committee can do in the way of investigating and what the Justice Department can do.
Well, there's a fascinating example of the kind of thing that we're learning from this that just came out on Thursday, not long before we sat down to tape. That was in the Cassidy Hutchinson interview, in which she's describing a conversation that she had with her mother. And she says, and I'm paraphrasing here for the family audience, she says, "I'm screwed because," and this part I'm not paraphrasing, she says, "I'm completely indebted to these people. And they will ruin my life, Mom, if I do anything they don't want me to do." I thought about that, Susan, as just a kind of an astonishing window into the culture within the Trump orbit, the crew, the people around him. What did you make of it?
Absolutely, Evan. It's one of those really revealing moments because, more broadly, the whole report is the story of this rupture between different factions in the Trump White House as they struggled with each other over what to do. And there was Team Normal, led by Bill Stepien, the campaign manager, and others who never accepted the rigged election idea, but essentially stepped aside, were pushed aside, were forced aside by Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and the other conspiracy theorist. And, you know, Cassidy Hutchison had a unique window into that. And in fact, she was pressured, according to her testimony, by someone who had the extraordinary title of ethics lawyer, quote unquote, in the Trump White House, who then became her Trump-connected first lawyer in this inquiry.
So the ethics lawyer you're talking about is Stephen Passantino, I think. And I agree. Is there ever a better oxymoron than ethics lawyer in the Trump White House? But at any rate, his role here is, I think, very interesting because there's the potential, reportedly, for him to be in really hot water. He is accused by Hutchison of having tried to get her to basically not tell the truth to the committee, say that there were things that she forgot, couldn't remember, that she actually did remember. And when she mentioned some unhelpful things she did remember, she reported that he said, no, we don't want to go there. If that's true, that he's a lawyer who advised his client to lie under oath, that, you know, he'll be facing disbarment. He has said it's not true, so let's just give him his side of the story here. But this brings up the, you know, part of what we're looking at here, which is the cover-up. First, there was the original coup attempt, and then there was potentially a cover-up as they tried to sweep things under the rug, talking to the committee, and in under oath in some cases. And the role of the lawyers in this is something that I think is incredibly interesting. Among the people who've been referred by the committee to the Justice Department for potential criminal charges are a number of lawyers, and chief among them is John Eastman.
Now, you've been paying a lot of attention to him. Remind folks who he was and how he came to be such a central player here, if you can.
It's interesting. He kind of emerges, it seemingly almost out of nowhere. I think he really shows up after the election when the Trump camp is trying to figure out how can they deny that Biden won. And he has some really fringe ideas that are very useful to the Trump camp. He suggests that there may be a way that they can come up with alternative electors or maybe use the legislatures to overturn the popular vote. Where does this John Eastman come out of? What's interesting to me is he comes out of a specific set of well-funded right-wing organizations. One is the Claremont Institute, where he ran a center for constitutional law, and which has been a center of some of the intellectual theories that justify the MAGA world. And it has pretty deep pockets, which is interesting, and Eastman was situated there. He's also been a law professor, and he's also got a nonprofit organization called the Public Interest Legal Foundation, PILF, that he is a director of, along with Cleta Mitchell, another lawyer who's embroiled in this, and several others who've been major election deniers on the side of Trump in all of this. And again, it's a nonprofit that gets deep pockets. It gets funds from major right-wing organizations like the Bradley Foundation, which has a lot of very well-known people on its board. What it shows you is that this far-right fringe legal theory that was giving cover to an attempted coup is not a complete outlier in the Republican Party. It's something that's connected into establishment sources, huge funding from very wealthy people. And in a way, it's really interesting just to see that if there was a coup attempt here, it wasn't going to be with, you know, guns and tanks in the streets so much as it was going to be done by fake legal theories and led by lawyers.
You know, John Eastman has been so eviscerated by this committee, both in the public hearing and now you see it in the executive summary that's been released so far. A lot of the testimony shows that he, too, was a cynical opportunist, right? So you have this fusion of Donald Trump, who is willing to grab on to anybody, right? Donald Trump doesn't care what legal theories there are. He just wants a legal theory that he can use to advance the crusade that he's already laid out even before the election that he was planning to seek to stay in power if he did not win. He does not, you know, it's not like he has anything invested in these bogus scenarios being peddled by Eastman. But he teams up with him and with others. And Eastman, again, I would recommend that people look at the testimony from the public hearings and in the executive summary. It's just brutal. Eastman admits to Vice President Pence's counsel, you know, that he knows that the Supreme Court would probably rule 9-0 against the theories that they're peddling. He suggests that it doesn't make sense to go ahead with the quote-unquote alternate state electors that on January 6th, that is not a route that would be constitutionally permissible. And yet he's dazzled by the publicity and the power and being in the Oval Office. He goes up on stage in that rally on January 6th at the Ellipse with Rudy Giuliani. And here's this dorky law professor up there with his cowboy hat. And it's really, I would recommend you look at that. It is an incredible moment of this guy peddling something he knows isn't true. It's cynical charade foisted on the American people.
You know, the other thing I was just going to say about Eastman is, in terms of understanding his place in the conservative legal movement, you're not talking about someone who's an idiot who doesn't know the law. This is somebody who clerked for the Supreme Court. He was one of Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court clerks, and before that, he clerked for J. Michael Luttig on the appeals court in Virginia. So he has sterling credentials within the conservative legal movement. He's not a complete nobody. He knows better, maybe. I think I've seen him describe how he tried. I actually interviewed him at some point for a story relating to all of this. And, you know, I think that he was trying to get Pence to go along with it by saying, it's a Lincoln-esque moment and you have to stand up and do the right thing kind of regardless of the Constitution and the law.
Which gets me, one of the things I find kind of amazing is, as Susan described, you know, his theories have been eviscerated. They've been roundly showed to be not only theoretically wrong and catastrophic, but also illegal in the eyes of the committee. But the question I have, Jane, is whether that undermines him and people like him in the conservative movement. I mean, one of the findings that the executive summary identified, as they put it, was that Trump believed then and continues to believe now that he is above the law, and they went on, and this may be more important, that the people who helped him try to overturn the lawful outcome of the 2020 election, if they are not held accountable, they will try to do it again, or people inspired by them will try. And that's the thing I'm wondering now is, has this process, whether or not it leads to prosecutions, been sufficiently humiliating, destructive, or not?
What the committee said when they issued the referrals was that the only thing that's going to really stop it is if there's accountability. That's what Thompson, the chairman of the committee, had said. And one of the kinds of accountability there is disbarment for the lawyers who participated in this. And beyond that, there's potential, you know, conviction and serving time. And it's not like that hasn't happened before. I think people need to remember what happened in Watergate. It seems shocking now in some ways, but the attorney general at the time, John Mitchell, actually was convicted and served time in prison afterwards for his role in the Watergate break-in and the cover-up afterwards.
But we don't seem to be on a fast track toward that happening to any of these characters anytime soon. Rudy Giuliani, I think, is the subject of disbarment proceedings, but not directly related to this.
So we now have a former president who has been referred for prosecution at the Justice Department. There is a history here, albeit a short history, of U.S. presidents and vice presidents who have found their way into criminal trouble, some of it bigger than others. I don't know how many people will remember that President Grant was in fact arrested for speeding in his horse and buggy, got off with a $20 fine from what we can tell. Where do you think Trump stacks up when we start looking at the history of people like Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, and others?
Well, Evan, I think this is a really important question because even now, 2 years after the fact, it's still hard to really reckon with the fact that Trump is the very first president in American history not to accept the results of an election and, in fact, to seek to overturn the legitimate results of an election. And, you know, essentially to defy the constitutional order, the principle of an orderly and democratic transition of power. He's the only one, Democrat, Republican, even, you know, people talk about, well, even in the Civil War, America was so divided. That's true. But Trump is the first and only one so far to have done something like this. So the nature of his offense, it's not a speeding ticket type offense when it comes to a direct challenge to democracy. And in some ways, that has made it even more challenging, however, because it's not about a collection of laws and statutes, although the January 6th committee suggested their version of which laws and statutes they believe Donald Trump violated when they made this referral to the Justice Department. But it's really fundamentally about someone who was in opposition to the constitutional order. And I think he represents a much more profound threat even than the kind of corrupt presidents that we've had before who've engaged in individual acts of wrongdoing, Watergate being perhaps the best known modern example of that. But, you know, Watergate was not fundamentally, you know, a challenge to the legitimacy of the government itself.
I certainly agree with Susan that what we're dealing with here is unprecedented. Yet Watergate, you know, was a kind of a good warm-up act in the sense that it was an effort to sabotage an election. And that's what Richard Nixon was trying to do, but by doing it through illegal means. But the people who broke the Watergate story, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who are experts on it, say when they talk about Trump that what they're looking at in Trump is way beyond what happened with Watergate. So and in a way, one of the things that I think's been interesting is watching what some of the historians are saying about all of this, presidential historians. I saw that Michael Beschloss, presidential historian himself, was saying that the Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon in retrospect, which looks like a mistake. And at the time, it was celebrated, at least by the sort of Washington establishment and for many years afterwards, as kind of a magnanimous moment that kept the country from falling apart and healed the wounds and allowed people to move on. And Senator Teddy Kennedy thought it was one of the high points of diplomacy and that this took place. But now, in retrospect, some historians are beginning to say it was a big mistake because it's allowed other presidents to think they can get off scot-free regardless of what they do, and that maybe that's the message that Donald Trump took from this.
I think we're right to talk about this accountability piece. I actually think that is going to be and is the most important sentence in the executive summary so far. If President Trump and the associates who assisted him in an effort to overturn the lawful outcome of the 2020 election are not ultimately held accountable under the law, their behavior may become a precedent, an invitation to danger for future elections. A failure to hold them accountable now may ultimately lead to future unlawful efforts to overturn our elections. I think this is the whole ballgame.
The Political Scene will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
it is a measure of how extraordinary this period really is that it is almost overlooked that we just this week finally got a summary of Trump's tax returns from the House Ways and Means Committee. We're going to get into analyzing what we know so far from that in just a minute. But I want to talk briefly about the fact that Trump's taxes have been an object of almost singular obsession among his opponents for years. Is it right to assume that they really do hold the key to truly understanding Trump's finances? Jane, did you find that this is a necessary step in the process? Or at this point, do you know everything you wanted to know?
Oh, far from it. I mean, when you're dealing with somebody who is has as complicated finances as Trump does, you kind of never know enough. I mean, every day it seems accountants find some new trick that his company pulled. So, it's helpful, of course, but it always seems that there's more with him. I mean, and this is an area you've been thinking a lot about recently, right? Aren't you writing about some of the ways the wealthiest people in the country manage to avoid paying their taxes? Or they don't like to use the word evade, do they? They call it, you know, tax avoidance, which is not a crime, and tax evasion is a crime. But what do you make of the size of the rather small size of taxes that it seems that Trump has paid?
Yeah, sometimes I think the easiest word is just escape, because it seems to encompass the full range of verbs. Look, I think what's striking about this is that we now know, of course, that Donald Trump paid zero taxes in 2020. And people look at that and they say, how is this possible? I mean, how is that possible? And the answer is that he's using what is a widely employed technique to be able to wipe away your income tax liability if you're extremely wealthy. He reported a loss of $4.8 million. And as a result, that meant that he didn't have to pay anything. And really, this is the extension of a very long pattern that we've seen in his life, which has been described in snippets over the years, particularly in the New York Times, that he would report these heavy losses for many years from other parts of his business empire. But the net effect was that he didn't end up having to pay anything. And I think there's a couple of things that come through very clearly in what we learned from the summary so far. I mean, number one is that there are some very questionable practices here. There are things that the IRS and other parts of the government are going to be looking at more closely, like whether they, in fact, were giving loans to their kids that really were gifts by another name. If that's the case, then they should have been taxed as gifts. They're also going to look at whether he was right to take a tax deduction for settling fraud claims about Trump University. But for me, I think the biggest point that I came away with was the fact that even now, in his late 70s in the presidency, the single most important piece of his financial picture was his inheritance. In 2018, he still got the final piece of the inheritance that his father left to him for selling a building in Brooklyn. I mean, it is the story of Donald Trump's business failures, is that ultimately he was riding off the tailwind that his father had given him, and yet he invented a persona in business and in political life about himself as a business success that was an utter and complete fiction. We know it, but in order to justify it and to teach it to our children's children, we have to know the numbers, and now we do.
Do you think, Evan, that there's the possibility to answer with these documents, or it will still take some yet bigger forensic investigation of his business to understand this question that we never have really had answered, which is, to what extent were Donald Trump's businesses dependent upon funding, financing, and support from Russian interests, Russian-connected businesses or individuals who helped to float him at times of trouble in his business? Both his sons at various points have said publicly that Russia did provide the bulk of their funding. They then retracted those statements when they became politically charged. Do you think we're ever going to know the answer to that? And do these documents potentially help us answer that?
Whether or not we ever get that piece of information, what we now know is that the process by which we might have learned it, could have learned it, was just woefully under-equipped, underprepared. I mean, the one of the things that's remarkable is that the IRS assigned a single agent to the audit of Donald Trump for most of the time that he was in the presidency. And what this tells you is that the IRS is just utterly ill-equipped at this point, under-resourced, in order to be able to assess anything as complicated and as deliberately opaque as a Trump tax return. I mean, the number of audits has fallen 60% since 2010, and tens of thousands of employees have left the IRS, and the government estimates that $500 billion a year goes uncollected, 28% comes just from the top 1% of taxpayers. Think about that. You know, we talk about money that the government has to do basic things. That is money that goes uncollected because people like Donald Trump are able to get away with, in a sense, choosing from a voluntary menu of things that they want to pay for, and they can figure out ways of writing off what they don't want to pay for. That is a deeper problem than one person.
And I think it's a great point, Evan, but it just to put it in the story about why that is so and what this says about Washington is that it's not an accident. There has been a deliberate campaign to cut the funding for the IRS and to demonize anyone who's an aggressive leader of the IRS for years by the Republican Party's leaders, and they've completely sabotaged the ability of the IRS to do its job, and nowhere more than in its nonprofit division, but also in terms of being able to even just keep up with the kinds of tricks that accountants who work for the richest people in the country use. I mean, they're no match for it.
Do you see, in the end, some connection between these things that we're talking about today? Susan, you know, we of course started by talking about January 6th and the committee and what they were able to figure out about potential criminal activity, and then we've covered also Donald Trump's taxes and the ways that those have given us an insight into the world that he made and inhabited. Do you think that they are, in some sense, bringing us closer to a larger understanding? I mean, are we getting buried by information, or are we getting smarter as a result of all this?
You know, is this the long-awaited accountability week, or is it in fact a reminder that Donald Trump has escaped accountability, right, to add to the list of questions? I think, look, Donald Trump playbook is his playbook. He's spun out any legal processes as long as he possibly can. In fact, the reason we're getting this January 6th report right now is because Democrats lost the House of Representatives, and they have to dump all this material out publicly because on January 3rd, the Republicans are going to take over the House. So is that going to provide accountability? Is the Justice Department any closer to indicting Trump because of this investigation that the House has done? It's not at all clear that's the case. Trump continues to run for president. He continues to be battered by bad publicity in doing so, in a sense that momentum is sort of leeching away from him. But at the same time, he remains a front runner, if not the undisputed front runner for the 2024 Republican nomination. And so I think we're on the knife's edge still.
Jane, as we get together again in January, we're going to be on the cusp of a new Congress in Republican control in the House. They have already said that they're going to be launching investigations of the investigators, of the people who were responsible for bringing all of this information to the surface about January 6th and Trump. What is the impact of that ultimately on politics, on Washington? Are we getting into a cycle that diminishes the power of these things, or does it mean that we're actually sort of building towards a period when there might be a breakthrough to a better era?
I'd like to think the latter, but I feel like it's kind of making a mockery of the oversight process and confusing people about what are really legitimate scandals and what are sort of faux scandals that are created in order for each side to say, you know, sort of have a point fingers and say, you're just as bad as we are, which is, I think, what these investigations are going to be that investigate the investigators. In the end, I think there are different kinds of accountability here. One is whether there really will be charges brought against Trump and his allies, and that's a hot potato burning a hole through the Justice Department right now. I'm sure it's something that Merrick Garland is thinking about every minute of his Christmas vacation, and you know, but there's another kind of accountability, which is simply the accountability of history, and that the public gets to get the facts, learn what happened, and make judgments of its own. And I think we're closer to that no matter what else happens, because we've had a committee that literally threw the book at Donald Trump.
Well, that book is one I think we're all going to be wading through. Nothing says Christmas like 700 pages on presidential misdeeds, but there we are. Jane Mayer, Susan Glasser, thank you guys as always. It is great to be with you.
Thanks so much, guys. This was terrific.
So fun to be with you always. Happy holidays, and hope your stocking has something other than just those pages from the January 6th committee.
It's going to be hard to stuff that into a stocking, 700 pages, but lucky kid who gets it, that's for sure. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Eli Cohen. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thanks so much for listening. Have a very happy holiday, and we'll be back next week with our year in review.